hace trampa, Batman, que hace trampa. Rana. Que ya ¿Qué, acabamos.
¿Qué pasa?
¿Qué hemos dicho que ya acabamos?
¿Qué pasa?
¿Algún problema?
No,
ningún problema, nada, en absoluto.
Pues antes, sigan ustedes.
Well, I'm gonna talk in English from now on, because it's very weird to have two people sitting next to me and having a conversation and me speaking Spanish and them speaking in English. I'm gonna turn that. There is a very good reason why I choose this sketch first, because it's very funny and I like it. And second, because it kind of summarizes many of the things and thoughts and ideas that are implicit in that exhibition, and it does it in a really funny way, using the sense of humor, of course, of two people which are quite brilliant. So, one, which is very important when you do a show which encompasses almost all the production of artists which have a long way to go, is how not to do a retrospective, how to present or you know, do a show that would create another kind of substance or another kind of situation where the works kind of inform a methodology and inform you about this methodology and their way of thinking, and also open up a space in which you could imagine this thinking in a continuous way, so that it's not fixed, that it would not stop there. And also, this is the method of how to, or how we envision the show to be. And the second very important thing is how we are going to frame, or on what kind of aspects are we going to focus in this particular exhibition. And I think that we three share a preoccupation with the, let's say, Western construction of time. So the notions of anachronism, I think you have seen it in the sketch, like Superman father and Superman son and, you know, all that. So it goes without saying. The notion of rhythm. So the idea of rhythm as being one very, very important element in a new thinking about ontology. I'm not going to go on and on about philosophy, but I think that this is a really interesting coming back of a notion that for many years has been almost forgotten, which is the particular role that rhythm plays in the conformation of duration. I think time is duration, but what makes time duration is rhythm. So you need a conception of what rhythm is and what kind of role rhythm plays in our understanding of what time is. And then the third, and very interesting idea as well, is how to control sense so that you can decontrol it, how to create a nonsense that would be not a game of language or a game with the materials, but another way of interpreting the real. How could a nonsensical interpretation of the real take place? And therefore, there is all these, let's say, combinations of materials that are present in the work of the Otolith group, and that's why the show has the form it has. So I don't know where to start, really, but I would like perhaps Kojo and Angelica to repeat something that they say in the press conference that I thought especially interesting, which was the notion that in this exhibition, everything happens twice. So perhaps you could start from explaining that thinking of yours.
I mean, the notion that that everything happens twice can be unfolded in several ways. Maybe the best way initially to think about it is to say that clearly there is, in a real sense, there's no such thing as repetition, such that repetition builds into itself a certain kind of delay. So the built into the exhibition is the sense that your forward motion through the exhibition is a continuous confrontation with a set of enigmatic objects. So you see things that you don't understand, you look at things you have no context for, you read titles that bear no relation to pastels, you read timelines concerning figures who you've never met and have no relation to. You're confronted with a series of enigmas. And gradually these enigmas are resolved, but resolved differently from how you expected. So that clearly the exhibition builds into it an invitation to return. And this invitation to return, this invitation to re-look, to revisit, is exactly what and how we understand our practice. So we think of ourselves as people who look again, and then look at how we look, and then understand looking in terms of comparison and in terms of contrast and in terms of succession and in terms of simultaneity. So we think of ourselves as editors. And the invitation to the exhibition viewer, the exhibition visitor, is to relate to the work as an editor and to approach the work in a relationship of kind of editorial imagination. So the work of comparison and contrast, the work of succession and simultaneity, the work of delay and anticipation, the work of prospectiveness, of looking, of a work that is calling forward in time and a work that is calling backwards in time. All of these we think of as kind of editorial gestures. And the editor is the figure who looks twice. Another way of looking at this is to say that we tried to open out the question of montage. The question of montage in its simplest sense is the question of what image should follow another image. What image should follow an image so that an opening is made. And the whole exhibition tries to take this cinematic notion of montage and work with it across the whole scale of the exhibition. It could be that the most cinematic works in the exhibition don't have any movement in them at all. It could be that the most cinematic works in the whole exhibition are sequences of photographs, for example, or sequences of visualizations of imaginary films. That's kind of one proposal that the exhibition throws out. What happens if we take that question of montage seriously? What happens if we take that invitation to edit the space and to edit the kind of implied associations? If we take that seriously, what happens?
But I also think it's something like, I think the double take kind of gives you the opportunity to imagine the exhibition or, let's say, the contents of the work as a kind of, you know, Easter egg hunt. So, you know, or as a treasure map, you know, where you're looking kind of for, I mean, that amazing book Masquerade from the 70s, where you kind of looked at this, there's all this kind of like mystique to kind of unpack. So I think that there are a lot of associations and a lot of histories in the work, and a lot of stories and untold stories. And I think the double take is like a kind of maybe like a clue for the editor, the person who comes to see the work, to begin to search for these kind of these Easter eggs, perhaps.
But how do you understand, when you say montage, how do you understand it? Because I think that it was a time that the montage in itself was a value, let's say. Or let's say, put it in another terms, like when cinema was understood as something that would have a narrative coherentness, or where the narrative and the image was kind of running together in order to build up story, then lots of people tried to dismantle the system, so to say. And the collage or the montage was in itself already a value, a way of breaking. So the fact that you were breaking with a genre was in itself enough, so to say. And then this kind of, it has been very interesting because that has been quiet for a while. And then some people that has been using it as a method of thinking, of putting together pieces that come from different references, and then using the collage of images and text as a way of creating a different kind of thinking. And I'm quoting, for example, Alexander Kluge quoting Einstein, where the collage and the montage plays a huge role. It's very interesting how they twisted. Well, it's not only the last works of Kluge, it's not only montage per se, but the montage as a new way of creating a cabaretistic method, where there is a cabaret in the way of combining. Because, you know, when you construct or deconstruct something, anyhow you aim at something, that's very difficult not to. And, you know, how do you understand montage in your work?
There's so many ways of thinking about it. Maybe one way of thinking about it would be to refer to a particular example. So when I first watched Chris Marker's Sans Soleil, Chris Marker's Sunless from 1982, what struck me, what amazed me, was the opening scene. So in the opening scene, he has an image of happiness. This image of happiness is two children with blonde hair from Iceland walking across a landscape. This landscape has just had a volcanic eruption. The landscape is full of black ash, and the children are walking along the landscape. The voiceover says, "This is an image of happiness." And then the voiceover then asks the question, what image follows this? What comes next? And then next you see the image of an aeroplane on a military aeroplane carrier, on a ship. So you see the ship, and you see the deck emerge, and you see the aeroplane. And then the voiceover says, no, that's the wrong image. And so right there, you had the drama and the hazard and the risk of what it means to follow one image with another image. An image which is wrong for reasons you don't yet understand. What I was amazed by was that every filmmaker knows this. Every artist knows this. But every artist, in some sense, hides it. And in some sense, what you see in the film is a kind of closed system in which one image follows another. But in Sans Soleil, in the opening sequence, Marker made the drama out of the failure to make this most basic unit of montage, simply an image that follows another image. This drama that everybody knows was foregrounded and then assumed a massive importance. And so in this moment gave me permission to imagine myself as an editor. I thought to make films I needed budgets, and I needed a car, and a car crash, and a girl, and a gun, and a landscape, and a subject, and a theme, I thought I needed all this. And then when I saw this scene, I realized that editing itself carried with it something like a drama, which was epic. And so for me, this was an initial idea of montage, the kind of the hazard and the risk of joining one image to another image, such that they somehow gave to each other their powers and their forces. One image gave to the other image a power, and then this second image gave its power back to the first, and so on. And this just suddenly seemed incredibly powerful and dramatic, and I felt I can fail too, and my failure too can be the work of art. I too can fail, and I too can elevate my failure, and maybe other people can understand it, because I understand Marker's failure, because he worked out a form for his failing. He worked out a form for his doubts and his anxieties and his suspicions and his criticisms. He found a form and he shared it. And I thought, I too could do this. I too could fail and find a form for my failure that everybody could join in. Mm-hmm. So this is what I understand montage initially to be: risk in an almost naively existentialist way. A montage is the risk of an image that follows another image. So this was my first understanding of it.
But there's also like one thing, which is like in what you are saying. I think you need to do films. You don't need the girl, the car, the gun, the blonde, which is kind of similar to what many press releases say. Like, I think there is almost no show nowadays that opens without a press release saying that contemporary art, what does is the production of knowledge, which is some sentence that is really annoying. And what you are saying is something, actually, you don't need to produce all that. What you need, probably, is to articulate, which is already produced. So montage then becomes a way of reading, because you are reading through the material that is a given, the images has been already produced, and then you can act, rearticulating them. And in this new rearticulation, in this new engagement with the image, then first you become a filmmaker, and second, you also are becoming an interpreter of the image, a reader of the image. But then the question is also, what are you then producing? Because the question of what's the outcome of this new reading is always there. Because the editing in itself, you know, when you articulate knowledge or meaning, you are articulating it for something. I think, let's say, what is the discourse on it? It's not the image itself, even if the image, it becomes really the primary source, but it becomes also the primary output or outcome. So how do you deal with that tension?
Well, I can only talk about, let's say, the emotion or a set of ideas that are linked to an emotion that we try and inhabit before the film is made. So, for instance, in Otolith 1, we were interested in inhabiting this sense of disillusion and displacement with politics, but also, you know, inhabiting this position of nostalgia in relation to, and proudly inhabit that state of nostalgia in relation to this history of Indian feminism and Indian feminists' relationship with Russian feminists, and this kind of fascination between these two very different groups of women. And we have learnt from Marker, I think, and from Black Audio Film Collective and other essay filmmakers, how to use poetry in a way, or how to think about poetry as a way to understand things that cannot be resolved. And I think that when one is working with the idea of montage, just to go back to that, this comes from this, I think, sense. I think displacement has a lot to do with it. When you're inhabiting a life, that you are existing within two very different ontologies, ontological realities, Britain, in my case, and India. And then you begin to realize that you're not going to be able to resolve these two kind of opposite ways of thinking about the universe. So I think poetry with images and poetry with sounds provides a way to out of this dilemma. But I think with Otolith 3, again, we were interested in inhabiting a state of alienation and inhabiting an understanding of what, or an emotion of what an alien might be or might feel like. And those were very real kind of emotions. Those were really very real inhabitations. In Nervous Rerum, the film we made in Jenin, we wanted to inhabit a state of hopelessness. So if the film for us does that work, if it produces that feeling that we are interested in, then for us it's kind of built, the internal logic of the work is working.
Yeah, I think this is one of the crucial questions of all the material, I think. One of the very interesting things is how to deal with emotions in contemporary culture. And also what you are saying, I think, how to deal with poetry in contemporary culture. I was reading the other day a book, which is one of my favorites, which is by Milan Kundera. It's his first essay. It's called Los Testamentos Traicionados in Spanish. And it's like something like Testaments Betray, I suppose, or something like that in English. And it's written in 1992. And then he analyzes two very important things. One is lyricism, the notion of the lyric, And the notion of the lyric versus the literary, and the notion of the lyric versus the political. And then he is giving really funny examples of translations of Kafka and translations of different moments in world literature in order to show something that I did realize, but never before in such a way and in such an intelligent way. And there is a moment in the book that Kundera says, I really hate the inquisition of sentimentality. And then he says, there is a moment in our culture that happened after the collapse of the Cold War, that people prefer eyes wet with tears than dry eyes, that people start preferring a hand which is close to the heart than a hand in your pocket. That actually, you know, he starts describing a whole series of gestures that symbolize the political in order to attack realism or to attack a new form of realism that in art we have been appearing through something that is called documentary or the documentary praxis, where the political takes a form that has a dream of matching the real, of making the eyes wet, of making the feelings present, but not every feeling, not inhabiting the feeling, but making you really walk away of the room with a hand in your heart, so to say. So, and this is a very important tension in your work, because the documentary material appears, but then the montage and the form and the way that you deal with feelings, which is something different than sensibility, is very particular. So I would like you to talk about that, because I think that sometimes, I remember one particular situation that I was in a screening of Autolit 1, and then somebody came in the room, stayed there for 10 minutes and say, wow, this is another documentary about, you know, the political situation of the Third World or I don't know what. And I remember thinking, no, this material is far away from the documentary. And we are kind of watching here a turn into that use of the real and the use of the subject versus the real, and also the idea of from where are you watching, because we are in Barcelona. We are not running in the streets of Cairo right now. And it's important to know that you are here and what are you watching towards that material. So it would be important that you elaborate a little bit on your particular understanding of that.
I mean, we can both do that in different ways, but I think the for me it was, obviously, you know, the whole history of documentary. It'd be very interesting to know what people actually think documentary is, you know. Do they think documentary is, kind of National Geographic, you know, or does one think documentary is, a film about, children in Iraq? I mean, what do people think documentary is? As far as I know and can see, documentary is failing to say anything about anything today. It's format driven, celebrity led, 40 minutes, there's nothing really. Independent documentary filmmakers from all over the world did address questions of truth and representation, at a certain time, like in the 70s or 80s, and their work was supported by, Western channels and commissioning editors. That whole kind of culture is dying. I mean, that's kind of happening now in the art world more, that filmmakers from different parts of the world are presenting their work within an art context, perhaps because a lot of these questions are being addressed. But yeah, where does documentary start? I mean, you know, this idea of going somewhere far away and filming something far away and bringing it back and talking about it. This comes from anthropology. And, you know that film that everyone must know by Robert Flaherty, Nanook of the North, which was a complete fiction on the life of this crazy Eskimo, you know, pulling whales out of the sea and eating them and whatever, and, you know, this idyllic life somewhere in Antarctica. So the subjective relation to documenting an event and putting oneself inside the experience of recording the truth and questioning what truth means and how one occupies a relation to truth and an image and a recording of an event, I think for me is where this whole question of, you know, what on earth does a documentary mean anyway, begin. So I don't, I've never trusted, you know, I've never trusted sort of the way that I haven't trusted documentaries that I've seen in British television for the last 15 years. There was a time when you'd have black audio film collectives work on television like Handsworth Song, and then you'd have Anand Patwardhan's work on Bombay, on Channel 4, you know, as well. But one knew that there was a dialogue that you could have about these films and about the representations of truth from Bombay to, you know, Handsworth. There was a kind of circulation of ideas that you knew that people were having conversations about this kind of material and these films. But this culture doesn't, you know, television is a place where these ideas were, you know, presented, and that's a very democratic space. So, I don't know, these are some of the things I'm thinking of in relation to that.
Because the Otolith Group also curates exhibitions on the work of filmmakers or artists or cultural practitioners who we admire, such as Black Audio Film Collective or Haroon Farrokhi, we've thought a lot about this question of the documentary, and we tend to use this notion of the essay film, and more specifically the notion of the essayistic, as a way to try to specify the kinds of work that we admire and the kinds of capacities and the kinds of powers that an image and a sound and a voice and montage and all of those capacities of movement and duration, the essayistic tradition seems to be a way, or offers a kind of tradition that we align ourselves with, which isn't to say we succeed, but of course to essay means to attempt something. So let's say we attempt to align ourselves with this tradition. And so for us, the essay film and the essayistic, this can be analysed. If you look at film history books, there's always a shorthand way of describing an essay film. That is, it has a so-called poetic voiceover, which is subjective, melancholy, nostalgic, somewhat sad. It has different kinds of archive which has been coloured different textures and has a new soundtrack. It has all these features. But for us, the essay film is not a genre. It is not that, you know, this is an essay film and this is not an essay film. For us, the essayistic can emerge in all kinds of projects and all kinds of practices. The essayistic can emerge in the middle of literature. Kundera himself is clearly essayistic. Kundera's interest in Diderot is clearly essayistic.
Yep.
In Jack the Fatalist. Clearly the essayistic emerges in photography, it emerges in all kinds of forms. And for us, the essayistic is not a genre, it's a discontent. It's a discontent with the expectations of what it is we expect, what it is we think an image should do in the name of the political. It's a kind of dissatisfaction of what it is we think a sound is supposed to do in the interest and in the name of the political. But it is a discontent with the image that is registered through the image. It's a dissatisfaction with the duties of a sound which is registered through sound. So we can't give up on images or sounds. We have to use images and sounds to register our discontent, our dissatisfaction, our distance from those duties and those obligations and those expectations. And so something like Nervous Rerum becomes a very clear example of this. In Nervous Rerum, the the question that we are preoccupied with and obsessed with is this question of overexposure. So this particular small geopolitical area of the world, of Palestine, the West Bank, the occupied territories, is overexposed, overfilmed. Cameras are there continuously. Films are there continuously. Filmmakers, image makers go there. And the image is a vehicle of value, which is presumed to carry back with it the news which will allow people to mobilize around the purposes of virtue. And so clearly what happens is a certain fatigue with image, a certain boredom with documentary, and a certain political exhaustion with images. And so if you will...
And with testimony.
Absolutely. So if you want to go to Janine and make a film, you have to ask yourself what it is you think your film is doing that every other filmmaker hasn't already done. And so maybe what you want to do is question the film that you will make through the film that you are making, and in this way register your discontent with this expectation and presupposition of the duties and obligations of documentary. And so this was the initial question that this particular project set out to answer.
Yeah, I think that, well, there is one very good reason why the documentary making has appeared with such a force in the art world. And I think that it's kind of the need or the urgency that many have been feeling with being synchronic with your own time. So there is two ways to be synchronic with your own time. One is that you get synchronic with, let's say, the entertainment movement of your own time, and you entertain as an institution, as an art institution, and you can synchronize culture with entertainment. So you are making it synonymous with you know, giving you something for your leisure time. The other way of being synchronic is a much more ambitious, which is the one that has to do with history written. I think if you are synchronic with your own time and you have an aspiration as an institution, and very particularly with an institution that deals with the collection, that deals with history, that is sensible to the ways that history has been written, and on top of it, you as a Western institution do deal with ideas of diachronic time, and then you get synchronic with your own time, so the documentary gives you the opportunity of talking in first person through others, which is already making you gaining power over history, because the institution is not only giving you what is already there, but it's also being a writer in its own right. The second step is that, of course, the system, the logic time we have been dealing with in Western culture has a form which is diachronic. One things follow the other. So the modus vivendi of many of these institutions like MACBA and very few others that try to kind of be synchronic in the correct way with a very responsible understanding of what the political versus the image versus the spectator could be and versus the construction of a common history which uses the collection is to introduce in this diachronic time, corrections, those kind of modular times like other modernities, for example, no? I think the Catalan modernity that is synchronic or it happens at the same time than the German modernity but is less important but still is there. And, you know, you are creating in that logic a logic of footnotes. You are adding footnotes to that, to that text. To the point that there is a moment where there is as many footnotes as hegemonic texts, so to say. So that's why the documentary has been so important, because the documentary helps to introduce a Bebussein. It helps to introduce a consciousness of this exercise. So if a museum wants more ambition than just have fun, then it needs to have a mission. And the mission is directly related with history. The problem comes with the idea that then you are also trapped into your model, which at the end is a model which is can be summarized by corrections. You are correcting history all the time because you are taking as a given that the real history has been already written by the hegemonic models, by the colonial, by the metropolis, by London, by Paris, by New York, by this and that. That history has not been written, let's say, in Valladolid, but somewhere else. And then you are correcting it. You start correcting it. You modulate it. You say, yes, but, indeed, and then however. And you start doing this all the time. But the energy of the corrections is not a propositive energy. It's an energy that never proposes anything for the future. It's just looking back. So what is very interesting in your work is that it's using something, which is a method that has been kind of, let's say, Nietzsche was very into it, which is trying to find an untime. So because we don't have any other model in Western culture, we have but the line, the timeline. This is one of the first works that you would encounter in the exhibition, because we Westerners do think that there is before and after Christ, that there is a zero time, and that things can start again, you know, from friendship to love to history to an exhibition to a calendar. So we are ruled by it. Nietzsche was the most amazing thinker, trying to get rid of that model. And then he wrote that book, which is called, Unzeitgemäß. No? He was totally based on the notion of trying to find an untime. An untime is not a non-time, it's not the negation of time. It's just trying to get rid of that line. And what I think is absolutely fascinating in your work is that you are doing kind of the same exercise, creating a movement in between the past, the present, and the future by mixing up elements that come from different genres, like the documentary, the filmmaker, you were talking about Chris Marker, but then you have also the posters of Jack Kirby and people coming from science fiction. So in fiction, we trust. No, because fiction is exactly the genre that gives us a mental possibility of imagining that otherness in time. And in imagining the otherness in time, we could also imagine a different time of a collection, of an institution, and then start thinking towards a future, or let's say better, towards a futurity, because you cannot talk about the future. The future is just a metaphor. But it's also impossible as a human being not wanting a future. You need to have it as a premise, because otherwise it would be pure entropic. So you cannot think that there is history made of Mondays. So I think that you should talk a little bit about this fascination with science fiction and these other models of writing history.
It's quite complicated. It's for us. Science fiction is a continuous obsession, which we've held on to since childhood, since long before actually working. And I think it emerges from a kind of a close reading of texts by novelists such as J.G. Ballard. And in J.G. Ballard's fiction, in High Rise, or Concrete Island, or Myths of the Near Future, The Unlimited Dream Company, Vermilion Sands, you find a kind of speculative acceleration. So Ballard always has these, he has scientists, he has architects, he has doctors. But these figures of knowledge production have somehow stopped producing knowledge in terms of their kind of rational function and have taken on a speculative and accelerative form. So you get this fantastic elaboration you get a kind of theoretical thought, but with the brakes off. So you get this speculative, convoluted, folded, Baroque imagination, but all in the framework of an expert or an institution. You get the same with Cronenberg. Cronenberg always has these institutions, yes, in Videodrome, in Raybid, in Shivers, in Scanners. You get these institutions with these scientists who have the role of authority, but whose authority has become entirely speculative and somewhat dangerous. So and so this really appealed to us a great deal. And so this notion of a science fiction of the present, which you get in Cronenberg and which you get in Ballard, is something that has a great impact on us. The idea that you really want to, in some sense, head off a notion of space opera in the kind of post-Star Wars, post-77 kind of conception of science fiction, and return to a notion of a science fiction of the next 5 minutes, as Ballard calls it, or a science fiction of 9 minutes from now, or a science fiction of the alien planet called Earth. In other words, a science fiction which kind of uses the capacities for alienation and uses it to create temporal disturbances, chronological disturbances, uses it to create anachronisms which set up kind of moments in which the line of time folds and convolutes and spirals in on itself. This seemed to us incredibly important. Just to wrap up, it seemed to us that that science fiction offered a way into a much broader question of what we could call the politics of futurity. And we characterize that you can characterize the whole 20th century very crudely, in the sense that you could say that, you know, the first 50 years of the 20th century were really bound up with the notion of the master plan. And then you could, you know, that whether that master plan was the Marshall Plan, whether it was communist five-year plan, there was the idea of a plan, whether it was a Corbusier project, it was the master plan. And then after the war, you could characterize the kind of the notion of the future in terms of deterrence, where you deterrence through simulation. So you simulate the worst, you simulate the kind of worst idea of the future in order to prevent it happening. So the idea of a mutually assured destruction, and the idea of a kind of deterrence, the nuclear deterrence, that's the kind of post-war 60s and 70s detente model of futurity. And you see that everywhere. But it's clear that now, post the 80s, the 90s, that we're into a notion of futurity, which is about preemption, in which you warn against the threat of a future, which you then trigger. And this is a notion of futurity which you can see, clearly we can see it in the Bush regime, but we can also see it in the financial sector to a great deal. We can also see it in all kinds of, let's say, biowarfare technologies. These are the kind of things that are being written about by Brian Massumi. A number of his essays cover this, and they have a kind of a great influence on us. So for us, science fiction is a way into this kind of broad 20th century notion of the politics of the future. And our work in a kind of very modest way is trying to tap into those questions and is trying to open them up, but at the scale model of art, the kind of very modest, low-budget scale model version of these kind of mega questions. We try to use science fiction to enter into this question of the politics of the future.
And I mean, it's also to give life to things, to ideas, to histories, to present histories that will never happen and are not able to happen. You know, if one thinks of, you know, the way that, you know, natural resources are just completely being destroyed now in a country like India, where seeds are sterilized, are created to self-destruct after 1 year, where farmers are committing suicide four times a week, four farmers a week are committing suicide all over the place, where, you know, nature has become commodified to the point that the, you know, people are at a complete loss and they just want to self-destruct. I think, you know, one needs to find life in these environments. One needs to give life. One needs to, you know, science fiction allows for many things to happen and remain in fiction, maybe, but at least maybe produce some kind of vision.
No, I just like, it comes to my mind that I was thinking the other day how less, I think when we were installing the show, and then, of course, all these science fiction things appear, like the posters, but we have been talking about the readings that inform the work, and even the fact that some of the materials are not works by you, but works that are important for you, and they are there, like the pastels of your father, or many of these elements. And then I've been thinking about how allergic the art world, funnily enough, is of fiction. Mm. I think when works are fixed works, they have nothing fictional in them. They're just fixed works. They have fixed meaning that belong to a tradition, and they symbolize a value, a historical value, aesthetic value, and they fix even the emotions and notions of the experience that you should attach to them. And then, you know, fiction, like the notion of fiction, has been also very alien to the art world in the 90s, where every, for example, you said now something very important. I think the whole 90s has been like, not the whole, but from the mid-90s, it was a huge conversation about the social in terms of participation and art being there as the playground for participation. But there's nothing fiction about it. It's an image of realism. And then all of a sudden we have two reference. You were just saying that in science fiction you have something almost operistic about the way that they, you know, function in terms of time, but also in terms of the participants, like an opera, where, you know, there is the real, but there is also the character. There is the acting, but not the participation. And I've been at the beginning of the talk talking and referring to Alexander Kluge, who by filming Das Kapital, the capital of Karl Marx, he proposed us a cabaret. And it's super important how he thinks about the cabaret, because in cabaret, the different sections of the cabaret are called numbers. Everyone has a number, an act. And therefore, you don't need to be an actor, because you just do your number. So you are not a good or a bad actor. You do good what you do good. And then it's like editing. Then the next person comes and sings or does whatever she or he needs to do. And it's a completely different language. And actually museums are, or institutions or the art world in general has been very skeptical about the use of that. But even the literature world, I think, you know, Samuel Delaney is still alive. And I met him in New York the last weekend. And he could not believe that he, as one of the major writers of science fiction, is read because it's gone. So he considers himself gone of the literary mainstream of the States and all that. So I think that's very important, and I would like you to say something about this notion of the participants, or how do you envision what happens in exhibitions like that, but also, you know, in the readings you do, in the screenings you do, how do you understand this meeting point that happens in between the audience and your work, which is not in the same terms of the participant, like in the 90s, or I understand it so, I don't know what you think, so... That's why.
Well, I'm going to sound very idealistic and maybe naive, but the, you know, I think I like working with films and with the essay film, because I think it allows people to somehow kind of think for themselves, but also one can return to the work. I mean, I'm not going to talk about our work, but like if I look at the work of if I look at Sans Soleil or look at Black Audio Film Collective, The Last Angel of History or Mysteries of July or Handsworth Song, if I look at Haroun Farocki's work and a number of other filmmakers, I constantly return to it, and the work continually provides me with a kind of elixir that survives time. And I think that when I think these artists, they want to survive time in a way, and the work continues to teach me something new. And in that way, the work becomes useful and durable. I think that, you know, that I loved the idea that films could produce discussion and films could be stopped and started, like in the Argentinian film Las Horas de las Zonas, this history of political cinema, where a community could be built around work. And I think that is very much part of what we are interested in, is building an idea of the commons around not just our practice, but in terms of our curatorial work, in terms of the questions that we ask ourselves and ask of our audiences.
Yeah, but it's very different to have to talk about a community as it has been used for the last 10 years.
Yeah.
And an operistic community, both are a community, or let's say a spontaneous theatre. I think I'm just playing Devil's Advocate. But, you know, to move away from that utopian idea that by watching and by being together we are a community, and then going to something much more absurd, the fact that we are not a community, we are in a spontaneous theatre play for perhaps the time we spend together, and this is going to affect us as you know, perhaps for the rest of our lives, which is also another possibility that may happen. Mm-hmm. So one is by total consensus. Mm-hmm. You need to agree. You are a community. You agree. We agree on the norms. And the other is not by consensus. It's by spontaneous generation. Mm-hmm. And also by the non-definition of roles. And also by perhaps another use of emotions, which could be by exaggeration. Mm-hmm. Because in a consensual, representative, democratic community, we are not allowed to have exaggerated feelings, for example. Mm-hmm. We should have feelings which are in the same tone. We need to have a political tone, the tone of what we call in the last 60 years dialogue. We have been continuously talking about dialogue, but in a cabaret or in an opera, there is no dialogue, meaning not in the same way. There is a tenor, there is a soprano, there is, you know, one that screams. Like, the whole thing gets, like, much more absurd. So I just tried to figure out if you would prefer an opera or a parliament.
I'd prefer an intifada. Yeah. So, yeah. That's...
It's another way...
Which means to spill over, you know?
No, definitely.
Yeah.
Another way of thinking about this, there's a... In the the first Terminator film, James Cameron's first Terminator film, there's this sentence which has always stayed with me from the first moment I heard it, and it's a very good working definition of anachronism, and it's the moment when Sarah Connor, who will give birth to John Connor, who will save the Earth, is visited by John Connor from the future. And at one point, Sarah Connor says to John Connor from the future, she says, "You're talking about things that haven't happened yet in the past tense. You're talking about things that haven't happened yet in the past tense." And this this folding of a future into a past tense, which is taking place in the kind of imminent urgency of a tense present, this feeling that Terminator conveys very well is it's something that we aspire to evoke by different methods and by different means, and so this idea of a kind of future interior space in which you are placed is not especially a space of community. Mm-hmm. It's an entirely different invitation, an entirely different poetics of relation that's been proposed in this folded and baroque space of the future anterior. And it's not for me to say whether we succeed or not. It's to say that that we're obsessed by this for reasons we can only partly explain to ourselves. We have to accept that the explanations we give for the work we do exceeded by the work. Clearly, the work has an autonomy that escapes us and that escapes our intentions and our hopes and our wishes for the work. Maybe the work begins at the point where it escapes our intentions of the work. And in fact, the point when we know the work is completed is when the work looks back at us with an alien indifference. The work looks back at us from a long way away. This work that we've been looking at for weeks and weeks and months, nonetheless, we look at it and it appears to us from a long distance off, the dying light of a fading star that we have no way of understanding. And then we know that the work has achieved its own autonomy, which is entirely indifferent to our understanding. And so,
it's like giving birth, you know, to a child that goes off.
And so it becomes at a certain point, there's something increasingly fictional about speaking about our work. And this is why I enjoy the work of artists who write. I appreciate the attempt of an artist to provide a theoretical reading for their practice, because this theoretical reading is clearly an entirely fictional form of writing which seems to bear the form of theory. So whether that's the 60s generation, mm-hmm. the Dan Grahams and the Robert Smithsons and the Mel Bochners, that generation, whether it's a more recent generation, I appreciate the inherent paradoxes of the artist who attempts to write the context for their work, or who attempts to provide a theoretical frame for their work, knowing that this theoretical frame is in no way a meta-language, but is actually more fiction, which seems to be a meta-language, but is nothing but. And it's something that occurred to me. It occurs to me every time we do an interview, that the interview is clearly that form.